This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America Secret Wars, the podcast all about forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately buried times the United States has used military force to fight or occupy foreign soil. I am your host, Trevor Cully, and today my guest is Cody from the Imperfect Men podcast, We Effed Up, and the Accidentally On Purpose network in general. Cody, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm broiling in our recording studio now, so by the time we're done, I might be, like, well-baked. So,
yeah, I am in an uninsulated attic, so I know that feeling.
Yes. But always ready to learn about whatever god-awful thing the United States did to X people in Y place.
That is the general theme of this show. So the question I like to start new guests out with, just because we are talking about things people don't know about, is what was your relationship to American history like in school? High school, college, whatever.
Let's say early on in middle school, I developed the reputation as the weird nerd who can name all the presidents in order. So there was that. But yeah, my, like, presidential history was kind of the first thing I got interested in, and that just kind of ballooned outwards, into, like, my general history interests, mostly colonial to antebellum America, which is also known as the slavery times. Fun stuff. But, you know, a little dabbling in ancient Rome, a little dabbling in ancient Egypt, but, yeah, so I'm always interested to learn stuff I didn't know, so.
Well, today we are going to go just a little bit past your, normal time period then.
Okay.
In all that history education, did you ever learn about a little incident where the United States invaded Korea is part of a larger regional conflict involving China, Japan, Britain, and Russia?
I knew we did, but I know nothing about it.
Well, that's good. You'll continue to know nothing about it, because I doubt we're talking about the same event.
Quite possibly.
We are not talking about the Korean War in the 1950s today. Instead, we're going 100 years further back to the opening of Asia in the mid-19th century.
Ooh, that's a touchy subject.
Yeah, this is a period where Britain, France, Russia, and the U.S. are all trying to force countries like China, Japan, and Korea into favorable trade conditions. And did you know that we invaded Korea in 1871?
No. No, I did not.
Yeah, never heard anything about that, right?
No. No, I I had no idea. Like, I knew we, like, forced Japan open, but I didn't know that, you know, we screwed around in the rest of East Asia at that time, so.
Oh, yeah, this is the capstone episode to a mini-series I've been doing on the opening of Asia. So the last couple of episodes have been the Opium Wars, an invasion of Taiwan, and the opening of Japan.
This just sounds like a fun time all around.
Yeah, it's a weird little period in world history, if nothing else, and features a lot of bizarrely poorly thought out attempts to colonize the Asian Pacific.
I mean, really, aren't they all poorly thought out?
Some of them had planning. The Taiwan episode featured 150 Marines marching into the jungle in their heavy wool sailing outfits and getting ambushed repeatedly by indigenous people. So
that's always like my favorite recurring theme is like when like some imperial power or, you know, more technologically advanced country, they go into a place thinking that, you know, how we've won before in, like, this flat grassland that was slightly cold will also work in this hilly mountainous area where the temperature is 120 degrees on a cold day. And we will change nothing. That's always my favorite.
Yeah, the wool uniforms, the heavy wool uniforms in the tropics is always one of colonialism's defining features for some reason for like 500 years, and they never figure it out. It takes until World War One.
Yeah, it's especially like reading about, like, especially when the French tried to retake Haiti or like hold on to it, and it's like, why would you send them to Haiti in the Caribbean with like layers upon layers of clothing? Like, why? Were you trying to kill them?
Well, the fortunate thing today for the Americans is that Korea is a little bit more temperate than some of these other places, but that doesn't make anything else that's happening better planned.
Okay, this should be good.
So for the last 150 years or so, this has been a very obscure event in American history, and not that much better remembered in Korea, honestly. It's basically been stuck in the realm of really, really obscure military history nerds. But fortunately for us, one of those nerds was Thomas Duvernay, or is, he is still alive, who is an American professor at South Korea's Yoongam University, and he wrote a book called Sinmi-yongyo, the 1871 conflict between the United States and Korea. So that was my primary point of reference today.
Yeah, it might be the only book on it.
I believe it is, and it was only published like 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So that's the kind of obscurity that I'm getting into here. To give some perspective on the situation in Korea and the world at the time, the Wikipedia page for Korean history starts with Homo erectus. So,
it's going way back.
It's the best named one, isn't it?
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
So people and proto people have been in the Korean peninsula for 500,000 years. And kind of ironically, ancient Korea works a lot like ancient Iranian history over on my other podcast, with most of our information coming from their neighbors for a few thousand years.
Oh, they're not biased at all.
No, you know, China and Japan have historically had very good relations with Korea.
Especially with half of it nowadays on China's behalf.
Yeah, and the other half on Japan's. Like, yeah. They've managed to reconcile sort of a little with half the peninsula, and that's probably the best anybody can hope for.
Yeah. I mean, people are still alive who remembers some stuff that went down, so, you know, not exactly the best, the most warm relationship.
Yeah, don't worry, we start getting to that at the very end of this episode.
Oh, great. Fantastic.
Great stuff. So, the important things to understand are that the Korean Peninsula shares a mountainous border with China, and over the centuries, various Chinese states and dynasties invaded, occupied, and subjugated the Koreans. But that border enabled the Koreans to maintain their own distinct culture and small kingdoms despite political domination by the Chinese. The southern end of the Korean Peninsula is also very close to Japan, but the ocean barrier slowed down Japanese political influence in Korea for a long time.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense, because, like, we have that natural barrier. It's like, you pay lip service to us, but we don't want to have to actually come in and wreck your shit whenever you don't, you know, pay us that lip service. So just, you know, just to keep everything nice, we don't want to have to come in there.
Yeah, you're far away and you are hard to get to. Just pay your taxes and everything's fine.
Yeah.
This came to a brief end in 1388 when a general called Yi Seong-ge seized power in a coup, overthrew the Yuan Mongol dynasty and China's puppet king, and declared himself king with a new name, Joseon Taijo. This ushered in the Joseon dynasty and a golden age for Korea, where they adopted all sorts of scientific, military, and artistic advancements. There was a Japanese invasion in 1592 that spurred rapid militarization in Korea, which actually helped them fend off the Manchu Qing dynasty from China a couple of decades later. The Qing did eventually get in and force the Koreans to pay taxes, but they didn't politically overturn anything.
Which is interesting because Korea is like just directly south of like Manchuria, like where the Qing come from. So you think that it's like, oh, we should like go in and take them just to secure our own backyard.
Well, that was what the first Qing invasion attempt was, and they got their asses kicked because Korea was full of veterans from a war with Japan. So they turned around and focused on China for a while and came back with thousands of Chinese conscripts. This situation lasted for about 240 years, and militarily, politically, China and Japan basically left the peninsula alone. There were internal disputes and minor civil wars after 1636, but for the most part, Korea became an extremely isolationist state during the later Joseon period, earning the nickname the Hermit Kingdom. Which I did not know until I was doing this research was that old a nickname for Korea.
Yeah, I've only ever heard it applied to specifically North Korea. I've never heard it used like for that far back.
Yeah, apparently it was revived in the 1960s and 70s, or maybe the 90s, I don't know.
By North Korea?
No, okay. For North Korea, based okay. on like these older records of using that name. It wasn't total isolationism, because that's not really possible.
Right.
But they mostly traded with China and Japan exclusively, and wanted nothing to do with outside people actually coming to stick around.
Makes sense. I mean, China and Japan are, like, right there, so it's like, yeah, why even bother with anybody else? Especially if, like, they can get, like, you know, goods from other places through China and Japan, like, why risk opening up to anybody else?
Right, and for most of that time, there really wasn't anybody else around. You might get the occasional stray merchant up from the Philippines or something, or down from, like, Siberian tribes, but nobody's really coming to Korea outside of those two places. Until around 1700, by which point all of East Asia was just crawling with pasty pale European newcomers who really wanted to harass the locals into trading with them.
Or converting them.
That was also one of their big goals, and usually the touchstone for pogroms, which we will see.
Oh, no. No. Why?
Yeah. Anyway. The Joseon kings wanted absolutely nothing to do with the European powers and told them to fuck off when they attempted trade. And since they were pretty isolationist already, the Chinese basically explained to the Europeans that those guys are just like that. Just leave them alone and it's not a problem.
Well, I mean, that's just like daring the British to just come a-knocking. It's like, we can't go over to this place or shouldn't. Let's go over to that place and see what's there.
Yeah, in this case, it was the French who really wanted to get in on the Korean trade, for whatever reason. I guess Britain was big in China, America was big in Japan, France felt like they needed to get their foot in the door somewhere.
Ah, France, always trying to get the leftover British and American scraps.
That's the entire concept of Louisiana. But this actually worked pretty shockingly well into the 19th century. But this is also the 7th episode about American interventions in East Asia during the 1800s. So that was going to change.
Yeah.
To recap and bring Cody up to speed, the United States was born with trade connections with China that we inherited from the British, because when your largest private corporation is also the government of India, trade with China was really easy.
Yep.
The War of 1812 led the U.S. Navy to expand rapidly as we got more involved on the world stage, and we started deploying small squadrons of ships all over the world to protect our trade interests.
And then once we get that nice Pacific land from Mexico, we gotta we gotta put some naval vessels over there and naval ports, which makes it far easier to make those connections with Asia than having to go all the way around South America now.
Well, we got the port of Seattle even before that, and that was our reason to have a Pacific fleet, and just kept going from there. We had a East India squadron before the Mexican War.
Ugh. That should say everything. Uh-huh. Was its only responsibility to go around and finding the islands made of bird shit?
No, that was a couple decades later.
That's another weird thing of history I love reading about. It's like, we need to claim all these islands of bird poop. It's like, what?
Yeah, that is happening. The Guano Islands Act is happening right around the time period where the action happens in this story.
Okay.
By the 1830s, the U.S. was so entrenched in the Chinese opium trade and that we participated in two whole opium wars about it. And all of this trade meant we needed coal depots, so we forced Japan to house them.
Of course we did. Because that's all they were to us back then was a naval depot.
Yeah, a naval depot and military proxy state.
Yes.
That we thought we could never possibly lose control over.
And we never did.
Uh-huh. That's why Japan famously on the Allied side of World War II. Korea doesn't really get into this picture until 1853, coincidentally the same year that Chandler from Friends was opening Japan at gunpoint.
I think I told Steve that once, and he was like, he had the most confused look on his face, like, what? Say it again? What?
Yeah, Matthew Perry, the actor. Yes. In 1853.
Yes. He was actually 150, 60, 70 years old when he died.
A good run. big in the early days of Hollywood. Friends with Chaplin, you know?
Also a communist. Had to flee America for a little while.
Yeah, everyone was a communist in early Hollywood. Now they just get called that by Republicans.
Yes. Ugh. Don't get me started on that.
An American whaling ship called the South America. That was its name. I don't really know how people chose the names for private ships, but that's what it was called. It just kind of pulled into the Korean port of Busan and hung out for a few days.
Hello there.
By all accounts, they traded and maintained a friendly relationship with local officials while they were in town. Probably because Busan was one of a small number of cities on the southern end of the Korean peninsula with a meaningful connection to the outside world. Because they had a large Japanese population that had settled there in the 1500s. So those communities continued to communicate and trade directly with Japan, which was now effectively an American proxy and trading partner, so there was some light interaction there.
Kind of helps the Americans get the foot in the door, so to speak.
Yeah, that is at least what I think this whaling ship was hoping, to be kind of the first people to start trading with Korea. But tensions with Westerners were already rising at that point because other European powers, especially the French, had been sending Christian missionaries in through these same ports since the 1500s, and by 1850s, they had converted a sizable minority of Koreans to Christianity.
The Moonies. Is where the Moonies come from?
I mean, in kind of indirectly, but yeah, like Christian cult in South Korea, that's its roots. That's how Christianity got there. Blame the French.
Can say that about a lot of things.
You can draw a direct line from King Louis to the assassination of Shinzo Abe.
King Louis, pioneer in home manufactured weapons. Little known French industry at the time. Later flourished.
Yeah. Yep. Love the thingamajig. So, despite what their captain and crew might have been hoping for, the South America's visit did not establish diplomatic contact between the U.S. and Korea. They were just some guys making a pit stop while hunting innocent whales for their sweet, flammable body fat. Also, weird fun fact about the South America, this whaling ship is actually better known as the USS South America because it was purchased by the U.S. Navy in 1861 and used as a dock while landing Union troops in Georgia during the Civil War.
Really?
Just weird coincidence that I ran across.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense that, like, the Navy wouldn't necessarily, like, want to, like, or they just needed a whole bunch of ships just to, you know, form the blockade around the South, so that they would probably just purchase or rent a bunch of, the, like, merchant ships, and then once the war is over, just like, all right, we don't need you anymore. Go back to what you were doing beforehand.
Yeah, I'm more surprised that this happened near the U.S. during the Civil War than the fact that it happened at all, because I think every episode of this East Asia series has included the U.S. Navy renting or buying some random merchant ship for military purposes.
Well, they had, like, no money at the time, so, because they weren't really taken as seriously as the land forces, so.
Well, that's the funny thing, though, is that up to the Civil War, the Navy was the military force, because a standing army would be at home.
Yeah.
And the Constitution is deathly afraid of that.
Yeah, heaven forbid.
But it wasn't that big, so they often, like, rented ships to spread out the crew across more ships than they were supposed to, so they could do more stuff.
Africa is a land with endless stories to tell. from epic battles, brilliant rulers, and the dramatic rise and fall of civilizations. Join us on the History of Africa podcast to learn the oft-ignored stories of the African continent. From the sands of Cairo to the plains of Zimbabwe, and from the mountains of Ethiopia to the forests of the Congo. Find the History of Africa podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the next decade, a few more Americans visited Korea, mostly by accident when it happened to be the nearest landmass to a shipwreck. And in the meantime, the U.S. East India Squadron almost ceased to exist during the Civil War, leaving one token sailing sloop on that side of the Pacific just to show that we cared.
We still care, please. Do you see our mighty sloop? We will defend you, West Coast.
Oh no, on the Asian side of the Pacific.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We will defend you, merchant vessels in Asia.
My listeners might remember that when we intervened in a Japanese rebellion in the 1860s, that sloop couldn't fight the wind to reach Japan from the Chinese coast, so they strapped a big cannon to the front of a merchant ship, merchant steamship, so that they could get there in time.
We can't get there, sorry. The wind is against us.
Yeah. And we have to shoot rebels, so we sent all of the good boats home.
Oh, God, yeah. I can only imagine, like, the crews around that time are, like, probably, like, the C and D list of the Navy. Like, these are probably the guys who graduated from the Naval Academy, like, last in their class.
They're all, like, old captains. Ugh. Like, all of the commanding officers on these ships look like fucking Santa.
I knew George Washington, like, once.
Yeah, and they're like commanders and captains in the Navy. Like, they have salaries, they could retire, they just don't,
because they have nothing else to live for, or they've, like, spent all their money already and they're like, well, I can't retire yet.
Yeah,
I need the money.
They spent all their money in Macau and have to stay there.
I don't want to know what they spent it on.
What, a bunch of old white men going to East Asia in the 1850s?
I'm sure their purchases were all above board.
We know what happens now.
Correct.
So this same time period, mid-1850s, late-1860s, overlaps with most of the topics I've talked about in the last few episodes. Listeners will hopefully remember that we talked a bit about the Taiping Rebellion in episodes I did with Roberto on the Opium Wars. This was a extremely strange, fringe, Christian-ish revolt against the Qing Dynasty in China.
Led by a man I have heard referred to as Hong Christ.
Hong Christ, the younger brother of Jesus.
Yes.
That revolt killed some approximately 20 million or more people and really poisoned the well against Christianity for most of Eastern Asia.
As it would with that many deaths. That is something I've seen, yeah, like throughout, like, Chinese history. It's like, you look at the death toll, like, take whatever you get in, like, the Americas or Europe or whatever death toll from, like, famine or rebellion or whatever, and just magnify it by, like, 10 or 20, and that's where, that's China. It's just, like, the death tolls are always just, like, just orders of magnitude larger.
Yeah, India's a bit the same way, not quite as extreme, but both being just really populous places, yeah, all kind of in one region of the country. You get that, but the Taiping Rebellion does, like, world war numbers of casualties, yeah, which is insane for the mid-1800s. The kind of counter swing to this came from religion and philosophy indigenous to East Asia. Specifically in Korea, that was Confucianism, which originated with the Chinese philosopher Confucius way back in the 6th century BC, and was the most popular strain of Chinese philosophy for a long time. and it was imported into Korea through the many various Chinese invasions. It did fall out of favor to religions like Taoism and Buddhism for a few hundred years, but it became an official state policy again under China's Ming Dynasty, right around the same time that Korea ousted its own set of Mongols. Technically, because of that interlude with Taoism, this version is what philosophers today call Neo-Confucianism. And the idea was to understand the universe primarily through logic and reason. Neo-Confucians tended to reject mystical and supernatural explanations, and viewed humanity as fundamentally good but corruptible if we didn't follow the underlying reason of a highly structured universe. It was a very hierarchical, very academic worldview that was imposed top-down on all of Chinese and Korean society at this time.
Sounds vaguely similar to, like, the cult of reason the French tried to institute during the Revolution. It's like, oh, this religion is entirely based on logic and reason and the world around us type of thing.
Yeah, state Neo-Confucianism is kind of a lot like that, actually. But part of that was both China and Korea developing an almost obsessive use of bureaucracy, trying to structure society as much as possible, to the point that Korea developed an entire upper-middle class of bureaucrats called the Yongban. They were landlords, but their official occupation was holding public office. They were separate from the actual nobility.
Landlord bureaucrats, that sounds like a nightmarish society.
Yeah, don't look too far into where our bureaucrats get their money.
Oh, God.
Because really, who could imagine a system where government officials primarily make their money from owning assets?
Oh, yeah, like the senators who held a classified briefing right before lockdown, you know, and bought a whole bunch of shares and, like, the companies that make PPE, and then, you know, lockdown is declared. That's just coincidental.
Well, you know, it's not insider trading if your spouse does it, because you would never tell them something from a meeting at work.
No, not at all. Never. Especially if it's classified.
And we can't make that illegal for reasons that we can't talk about.
Especially given certain recent court rulings.
Yes, well, I mean, that's an official act, Cody.
Yes.
Anyway, the 1800s were a rough time for the Joseon. Their succession rules were not strict, and the powerful Andong Kim family became the de facto rulers of Korea through a series of kings that inherited the throne as children and died young. So there was constantly a regency.
That doesn't sound suspicious at all.
That's what I thought at first, too, but as far as I can tell, there's not much conspiracy here. Just a bad combination of noble inbreeding and bad luck that led to a lot of illness.
Well, that'll do it.
Like, every single one of them, I find, has, like, years-long chronic illnesses before they die, so I guess, like...
This is the Korean version of the Habsburgs.
Shitty immune systems. Yeah. In 1864, the king died without an heir, and his 12-year-old nephew, Gojong, became king of Joseon, with his father, Yi Hyun, as the new regent. But usually, the father here is known by his official title, the Daewonggun, which means, like, the ruling prince. King Gojong was chosen by a council of widowed queens because there were three of them who had all outlived their husbands, and all three of them were actively involved in court politics.
That doesn't seem like a problem at all.
Yeah, it sounds like a Game of Thrones plotline.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just imagining what was the old lady Tyrell?
Olena.
Yeah, her. It's like, multiple versions of that. It's like, that doesn't, that seems pretty schemey.
Well, it's more like if her and, you know, I don't know, Cersei Lannister and one of the, and Sansa Stark were all on the same side for some unholy reason and plotted together.
Yeah.
Like, it's like three separate generations of queens. But this all signaled a major change in Korean politics, because though Gojong wasn't king or wasn't an adult, having his father, another member of the royal family, control the kingdom, backed up by three generations of queens, they had some actual institutional power around the throne for once. Huh. So the Daewon-gun stripped the Yongban of power, and centralized it around the royal family. Really, he gets Father of the Year for 1864.
It sounds similar to, like, Japan, like, way, way back in the day, where it's like, you have an emperor rule for, like, 10 years or something, and then they would, quote-unquote, retire and have, like, their young son or someone else take the throne, but then that retired emperor was, like, really the one pulling the strings behind the scenes type of thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, choosing someone young for appearances, so, you know, someone with a political reputation doesn't have to take the flack for it. Like, there's a bunch of politicking going on in the background there. So the Daewon-gun was a staunch Confucian who saw all this chaos in the, you know, the whole region in general as evidence that Western influence would only degrade Korean society. I can't say he was wrong, and he adopted an even stricter isolationist policy than what already existed. Cutting off trade with Japan and the Western powers entirely, and outlawing Christianity flat out. He encouraged pogroms against Korean Christians, and Western missionaries were unilaterally sentenced to death.
That's not gonna come back to bite him in the ass.
No, it's not. It wasn't a motivating factor of the First Opium War or anything.
No.
This predictably pissed off all of the Western powers whose people had been attacked, primarily France, Britain, and the U.S. And that was the situation the first time an American tried to force Korea to open up to foreign trade. But this was not an official government action. Instead, Cody, I want you to imagine the dumbest plan for this attempt that you possibly can.
Oh boy, that's saying something.
And I promise what actually happened is dumber.
I'm gonna guess that France, Britain, the US, they get together, they secretly hire a Japanese fishing vessel, but they staff it wholly with their own people. And they covertly get into Busan in Korea. They land this, let's call them a special ops team, who go in and just wreck up the place.
See, that might actually have accomplished something.
I was giving them too much credit.
So, far too much credit. In early 1867, three men in Shanghai conspired to force the Koreans into trade with the West. A wealthy American merchant, a French priest, and a failed German businessman.
This sounds like the beginning of, like, a priest and a rabbi joke or something. Like, these three people walk into a bar or
right?
something. Yeah, that failed German business. Like, what was his failed business?
So this was Ernst Oppert, who is potentially the most unexpected crossover character with my other podcast, History of Persia, that I could possibly imagine.
Was he like a failed archaeologist?
Sort of. He was a German Jew from Hamburg, and the third son of a well-off banker. All three of the Oppert boys became Orientalists, which is old-timey speak for people who study anything east of Greece.
Yeah.
His brother Gustav worked in India, and the middle brother, Julius Oppert, really caught me off guard because I've read his work before. He was a major figure in the early archaeology of Mesopotamia and northern Iran. Some of his linguistic theories were nonsense, but some of his writings are the only records of important archaeological finds that were lost in a pirate attack.
That was not how I was expecting that sentence to end. Lost
it, it gets better when I add the detail that it was a pirate attack on the Tigris River. They weren't even out to sea yet.
What kind of pirate boat was it then? It was just like a little, like, the 1800s version of, like, a motorboat?
Oh, no, the Tigris is massive. You could, especially before they built up hydroelectric dams, you could sail pretty large sailing vessel up the river. But yeah, so unexpected History of Persia crossover there.
Yeah, archaeological finds lost in the were the archaeological finds that were taken in the or records in the pirate attack, were they recovered from the pirate attack?
They sunk to the river and were washed out to sea.
No, god damn it.
Yeah, so weird coincidence here. But Ernst, our failed German businessman.
Oh yes, I forgot about him already.
Yeah, right. He moved to Hong Kong to become a merchant in 1851, which was a distinctly terrible time for a European to start trading in China.
Yeah.
Because the Opium War started the next year.
That's what I was thinking, like, that was a good timing, buddy. Didn't foresee the economic forecast on that one, did you?
Yeah. As his company failed, Ernst did spend a lot of time translating various Chinese historical and philosophical texts, earning him a vague place alongside his brothers, but never to quite the same degree. And his company went bankrupt in 1867, so he started making illegal visits to the Korean coast.
Of course.
This is what inspired him to meet with his co-conspirators later that year. The wealthy American is probably the least absurd of those involved. His name was E.F.B. Jenkins, and he was the money man, supplying cash for supplies and a ship and guns. The French priest was Father Stanislaw Ferron, and he was the brains of the operation to the degree that any of them had brains.
The French priest's name was Stanislaw?
I don't make the rules.
I feel like he might have immigrated from somewhere else.
I am assuming border region, okay. Right. French priest. But Father Stanislaw was a member of the Paris Foreign Mission Society, which had sent him 10 years earlier to illegally proselytize in Korea. He had to flee in 1866, when most of his mission was captured and executed by the authorities.
That'll make you flee.
But while there, he learned a little bit about Korean culture and geography, like how they valued their ancestors, and where the royal tombs were located.
I can see where this is going.
It's still dumber than you think.
Were these tombs booby-trapped? I know, like, some Chinese tombs were booby-trapped. Were these ones booby-trapped as well?
No, not booby-trapped. It's still dumber. Together, Jenkins, Ferron, and Oppert conspired to hire a team of Chinese mercenaries that they would take to Korea and open the tomb of Namayon, the Daewon-gun's father and King Gojong's grandpa. There was just one problem. Stanislaw Ferron, the priest, knew where the tomb was, but he had never actually been there.
Oh, no.
So, with Oppert leading the expedition, they arrived at the outskirts of Seoul. And let me just pull up a picture for you. When they got there, they found this.
Interesting design.
Do you want to describe what you're looking at?
Well, it looks like a giant mound of, I don't know if that's dirt or hay or something, but the with like a few, you know, masonry works around it, a few little statues. One looks like a bench. The other one's positioned to where it makes the tomb look like a giant boob. Yeah, it just looks like a giant pile of hay.
Yeah. So that kind of thatched straw dome thing on top, that's not the burial chamber. It's part of the monument. But that big slab underneath is the actual lid to an underground grave.
Oh, I see. They thought it was like an above-ground tomb. Oh, no.
Father Stanislaw had been led to believe that the lid was a thin sheet of metal, something relatively light that a few men could lift and carry away. In reality, it is almost a foot-thick slab of cement.
Oh, that's not gonna work. I don't care, but...
Yeah, they would have needed a lot more Chinese mercenaries. So Ernst Oppert and company weren't able to do anything here except desecrate the monument on top of the tomb. So they fled, but by then the Korean army knew where they were, and the Koreans were, understandably, pissed that anybody was trying to rob their royal tombs, let alone a bunch of foreigners who were explicitly banned from hanging around outside the capital.
I can imagine that that would incite some anger.
So they did escape, but only after engaging in a brief gun battle along the Han River as they fled to their boat with the Korean army.
Wait, so did the Korean army have like guns, like muskets or like that kind of weaponry at this time, or is it like out of date guns, like a blunderbuss or something?
Yeah, it is primarily pretty outdated by this time matchlock rifles. This mercenary company and, you know, the guns that their American backers were willing to provide probably weren't state of the art. They were probably like Civil War surplus Springfield muzzle loading rifles. The difference in weaponry will come into effect a little bit later. So after this embarrassing clusterfuck, the Korean government was even more hostile toward Western influence. EFB Jenkins had to eat his losses and stick around in Shanghai to continue doing business. Stanislaw Faraone moved to India, where the British Empire wouldn't try to murder him for preaching to the locals. And Ernst Oppert went back to Germany, where he was briefly arrested and jailed for grave robbing before going on to publish a book about his misadventures.
He's like, look, all right, this didn't work in Korea, but I'm going to go back home, I'm going to try it there. I'm going to perfect the art of grave robbing, and I'm going to be the maestro of it. I'm going to be the guy that people go to, like, hey, I want to rob that grave. Well, Ernst is your guy.
He's got to be the very best. Collect them all.
Collect all the graves, yes.
That's why that tomb looks like the top half of a Pokeball.
Africa is a land with endless stories to tell. From epic battles, brilliant rulers, and the dramatic rise and fall of civilizations, join us on the History of Africa podcast to learn the oft-ignored stories of the African continent. From the sands of Cairo to the plains of Zimbabwe, and from the mountains of Ethiopia to the forests of the Congo, find the History of Africa podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
But a few months after this mess, General Sherman arrived in Korea.
Like William Tecumseh?
Okay. No. Not the Civil War hero and genocidal maniac. He was busy with a series of battles that were effectively an ethnic cleansing of the American Northwest. This is the part where I say, I will do an episode on that eventually.
Ugh, God. That's why I was like, I went into this, I'm like, this is one of the Indian Wars, I'm gonna get real depressed.
Nope. Korea received the SS General Sherman, an armed merchant ship out of Boston with one of the most eclectic crews imaginable. It was owned by an American named W.B. Preston, who was on board but hired an Englishman to act as his business manager on the ship. The captain and the first mates were also Americans, with a crew of 13 Chinese sailors and two passengers, a Chinese currency exchange officer, and a Welsh missionary.
I don't know why, but, like, the Welshman, like, just is, like, the cherry on top of this crew.
That is why I put him last, yeah.
I like to hope he's, like, really Welsh, like, to the point where, like, he doesn't speak English, and everybody's just like, what the fuck is this guy saying? It's just like, what is he saying? This is an incomprehensible language.
He's handing out Welsh copies of the Bible that are twice as long as they need to be. So they stocked up on Chinese and British trade goods in Tianjin before setting out. They began sailing up Korea's Taedong River on August 16th, 1866, stopping in villages along the way to hand out Korean translations of the Bible. Local officials warned them that they were not allowed to trade in the Hermit Kingdom, and they ignored that.
Of course they did.
Things may have gone better if they arrived at a different time, but the Daewongun had just executed several French priests, and one of them escaped to report back to his countrymen the previous month. So the Daewongun assumed that the General Sherman was a French warship sent to exact retribution. And after about a week in country, the ship ran aground in a shallow stretch of river and sent a foraging party out to get supplies while they made repairs. The foraging scouts were captured and forced to lead a Korean naval ship back to the General Sherman.
What?
What?
Like they put the prisoners in charge of a Korean ship to fight the General Sherman?
Oh, no, just give directions.
Oh, okay. All right, that makes more sense. Sorry.
Yeah, okay. Just as guides. So the Korean military was under orders to threaten the intruders, and the crew of the General Sherman, under orders from their American ship owners and first officers, attacked without warning and took the Korean crew hostage.
Oh, this is just turning into a giant clusterfuck.
Some local Koreans had come out to see what all this fuss was about, and when they saw the invaders attacking their own people, they started throwing stones and called out the village militia, which showed up with bows, arrows, and at least one huacha. Cody, have you ever heard of a huacha?
It sounds vaguely familiar, but I would imagine I've only heard of it when playing as the Koreans in Civilization.
That's one of their units. It might be their replacement for musket men or something. Or maybe cannons. Yeah. So the huacha was pretty outdated by the 1860s, which is probably why some random village militia had one. But they are basically an early form of rocket launcher or weaponized fireworks.
That sounds fun.
Explosives were attached to a bunch of arrows that each had their own slot in a great big grid, which was on a cart with a bunch of fuses hanging
out
the back.
Yeah. I have heard of this before. Yes. Okay. I see where this is going.
You light the fuse either one at a time or a whole bunch of them all at once, and the arrows go flying, embed in the target, and explode. So basically, this illegal missionary adventure turned into a battle. The General Sherman started firing its 12-pound cannons into the surrounding villagers and militia, and they used sheet metal and cow hides to create impromptu armor over their main deck. A Korean soldier slipped out of his bindings and freed his commanding officer, so they rowed away in a stolen American jump ship and came back a few hours later with a Korean turtle ship, a big, not metal armored, but kind of wooden domed, sort of Korean warship that provided cover from the American guns. And they brought 9 smaller boats that had been emptied out and packed with explosives, then set on fire to ram the Americans.
This is escalating pretty quickly.
Seeing this coming, everyone on the General Sherman abandoned ship into a crowd of very angry civilians and militiamen who they had been shooting at for several hours, and were promptly ripped apart by the mob.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't. We either blow up or we get ripped apart. Take your pick.
I think I would have stayed on the ship.
it sounds like, you know, death would be more instant as opposed to slowly as you're like, your limbs are being ripped off.
Yeah. The Koreans were able to salvage several of the American cannons and took them to the Daewon-gun in a celebration of their victory against France.
So,
because they never bothered to figure out who these people were.
So the French weren't even there, and they still lost the battle. That is the French way.
Well, that celebration made it a bit embarrassing a few weeks later, when 5 actual French warships arrived and assaulted Gonghwa Island near Seoul. The French were able to occupy the island, but Korea responded with overwhelming force that resulted in a stalemate and a French withdrawal that November.
Well, at least the French, like, did a better job than the General Sherman. Oh, man.
Yeah, well, you know, 5 warships versus like a dozen random guys.
Yeah, they're gonna win that one, but yeah, I'm just imagining like this ship just like on fire, like at all these guys being torn apart, and the Welsh missionary is still like on board, just like praying to God, but he's still just like going on in Welsh, and nobody can understand what he's saying.
Yeah. And that ended it for the General Sherman.
I would think so.
Yeah, uh-huh. Korea still wanted nothing to do with American trade. That's all we have to say about the history. Cody, this is where you can tell people about your shows and anything else you want to tell them where to find you or on social media or whatever.
I am the co-host of several productions in our ever-growing list of stuff we're doing. AOP, Accidentally on Purpose, Productions, Pod Network, whatever you want to call it. It's just kind of an informal thing my friends and I do. Like, whenever we come up with a project, let's go do that, and then we commit to it, and then we end up with, like, 5 projects at once, and it's like, oh, this is too much. But the shows I'm doing now, Imperfect Men, which is a Rexy Pod format, history podcast where we talk about founding fathers of the U.S., rank them, decide if they're a founding or a floundering father. We've done a few other shows that are done. We effed up another history podcast. We have some shows about movies. No Time to Bleed, Hard Ticket to Sedaris. A few other projects. You can just go to aoppodnetwork.com, or you can look us up on Twitter. We have all like a list of all our stuff we're doing there, so you might find something that interests you. So,
all right. And if anybody wants to hear more of my voice, you can go listen to my other podcast, History of Persia. You can follow me online at History of Persia or at History of Persia Podcast, because I don't like setting up multiple accounts. And if you want to support these shows, head to your platform of choice, leave a review, or subscribe to get access to bonus episodes and ad-free listening at hopfulmedia.com.co. And until next time, don't try to rob any Korean tombs.
I forgot about that part already.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.